Like notes to the hourglass. These are the songs of our lives.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of Songs of Our Lives. I'm Brad Rose. I'm an artist, a composer, a writer, the founder of Foxy Digitalis, and someone who thinks about music and sound far more than is healthy. Each week, I invite on a guest to talk about the songs and the music that has meant a lot to them and left its mark. Previous guests include Maurice, Wendy Eisenberg, Weston Olinsky, White Boy Scream. The list goes on, but this week, I am so excited to have... It's Ryan Sawyer. Let me just get into that. Ryan is, like I say this in the intro when we get into it, he's your favorite artist, favorite drummer. He's played on so many incredible records over the years and so many amazing projects. And I was really excited to have him on the show, especially because he's got a record coming out. It's Ryan Sawyer's Shaker Ensemble called For Those Who Wish to Sing, Will Always Find a Song. It's coming out October 3rd on Lobby Art. Great label. Great record. I love this record so much. The highest compliment I can pay to it is that sonically some, yes, sort of, but just the spirit of it, the idea behind it or part of the idea behind it or within it, it reminds me of Organic Music Societies, and I can't pay it a higher compliment, honestly. It is an extraordinary record. It is one that gets better the more you listen to it, the deeper into it you get. It is not a record it works as passive listening, but it is very, it's engaging, and there's such intention behind it that I find every time I put it on, I just have to stop and listen, and it makes me smile and it makes me happy. And it's an extraordinary record. So highly recommend checking that out. Ryan's always doing stuff. Go follow him along, his website, Instagram, all that stuff. 'Cause he's always up to amazing, cool stuff. So this episode was an absolute blast, a joy, if you will. And I hope you, dear listener, enjoy it too. My guest today is an artist, a drummer, a musician, probably your favorite artist's favorite drummer. It's Ryan Sawyer. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So you've got this new record coming out next month, October 3rd, via Lobby Art. For Those Who Wish to Sing, Will Always Find a Song. I love the title. I love everything about this record. Can you kind of just, for people maybe who aren't familiar, just give a quick rundown overview of what this record, because it's not,
sure,
it's not really a solo drum record, like, at all.
Not at all. No, it's a very the opposite of that. Yeah, so it's this piece that I wrote for like kind of a small orchestra, small ensemble of kind of classic instruments, trumpet and viola, cello and everything. But it's sort of framed there's kind of two main things that frame it. One is that I do this thing with maracas, hence the shaker name or whatever. But it's, the maracas, I've learned or developed this way of playing them to where they're out of phase with each other. And so they start to get this sort of like hallucinatory, real trippy sound to them because of playing them just slightly out of phase and then coming back to them being steady, kind of like these steady eighth notes.
Mm-hmm.
And, I found it to be really intriguing, and they're kind of a mismatched pair, so they both have their own unique timbre and everything, and so they play off of each other really well. And then the other sort of framing of it is that there's this very vulnerable singing that everybody does. Mm-hmm. And the singing is also, you know, the whole point of the record is a very meditative, self-healing exercise. And you know, and it's an initial intent with that. And then, of course, then I have these incredible musicians that I'm playing with that that, you know, surpass whatever intent I had, and it becomes its own, you know, incredible thing. It's a very trust-based, open piece, but it's, you know, it's very specific in a lot of ways. It's, you know, it's exactly 44 minutes, and it tells you kind of binarily, like, when to play and when to not play, when to sing and when to not sing. But and also it's pretty open-ended in the sense that you can ignore any of the rules that I have, and everybody just kind of turns it into what it needs to be. So it's a live recording that we did in January, and it's coming out next month. Yeah. It's very exciting.
There was mention, like, in the, I guess, the album description or whatever, talking about the performances at Union Pool, where you would invite strangers basically, or to audience members, to just sort of start singing. I'm curious what that was like, you know, speaking to the vulnerability, like, to me, that takes a lot of vulnerability on both sides. I'm curious what the moment was like when someone first, like, joined in.
You know, it's pretty hallucinatory piece, so I didn't necessarily notice, but yeah, that's a cool thing. Also, it's New York, so everybody's a little too cool to really in earnest join in. But I look forward to doing this piece in other places, and, you know, and also, like, there are people who definitely did sing along, but it's, you know, it's pretty private. Nobody was really going for it that I noticed. Sure. The couple of times I've done it, and that it's only been I've maybe done the piece maybe 7 or 8 times, and that the second to last time, the live recording was the first time,
right,
that I invited the audience to sing along. The liner notes, or the description that you're talking about, is by a good friend, Margaret Welsh, and she definitely sang along. I only know that because she told me. I didn't necessarily know it in the moment.
Sure.
But the idea is that it's, you know, we're all in this room together, and that we're all, you know, it's sort of supposed to be, you know, it could be an ecstatic state that we all enter into by participating with the piece. But listening is, you know, just as important, if not as important, you know. And that's been a really incredible hallmark of this piece, is that people really listen when it's happening. And I'm not sure why it is the way it is, but I mean, I think, you know, the maracas really have this powerful thing, and it's cool. It's an engaging piece for sure to see live.
Speaking of the maracas, I'm curious I really love the story behind that. So they were given to you as a gift for, like, helping someone move. Is that right?
Yeah. This frontline vets, Stathos, percussionist, and she actually has the other pair, the mismatched other pair. Oh,
nice.
So at some point, I don't know, there's some potential there. It was a funny thing that how they entered into my life, because, you know, like, yeah, it was during the pandemic, and I just helped this person move some stuff out of their place, or they were, I can't even remember the exact details, but nevertheless. And so I had these pair of maracas just kind of sitting around as, like, a thank you. And I mean, you know, and it's also like, when you help somebody move, it's kind of like, in New York, it's often, and anywhere, but it's often like, you know, actually, will you just take some of this stuff away from me? Right. So, I mean, it was a haphazard gift in a certain way that had a lot of serendipity to it, because I started just toying with them at my studio. I was just spending a lot of time in my studio because of the pandemic and not having anything else to do. And the more people that I'd invite over to get together for sessions, you know, I remember the first time I kind of was, like, playing them, and it was with my band Darlin, which is Wendy Eisenberg and Lester St. Louis. And Lester is a member of the ensemble, but I remember being like, hey, is this cool? And they were both like, yeah, that's cool. And, like, Lester, like, really made a double take and looked at me, and he's like, that is really cool, because just the way, when they start to go out of phase with each other, they really It's a hypnotic. And so I kind of made that a thing of when I mm-hmm. was getting together with lots of different people just to have a session, just to have, you know, get to know each other in that way. And everybody that I got together with, you know, I play drums and they play their instrument. And then inevitably I'd break out these maracas and it got, I mean, the reception of it was stark. I mean, it was very like people really, so like, you know, Laura Cox, who's in the ensemble, and Jessica Bavone and Madison Greenstone, like all these people, you know, were like, it started to have a life of its own. I would be like at a dinner party and some, like Madison, I remember coming up to me and being like, and we didn't really know each other that well. And she was like, you know, so what's up with these maracas that everybody's talking about? So it started to have, wow. I remember like Laura Cox wanted to analyze it, like the sound, you know, like the, there's some sort of like app that you can, you know, see what the frequencies are that it's playing with. And, you know, it was very engaging to people. And so it made me, you know, invest more energy and thought into what is possible with it. And that's kind of how the ensemble was born. Is, you know, I had Nate Woolley come over, I had, you know, several people. And then at this point now there's people who've seen the piece who are now included in it because they've really, like Zena Parkins wasn't initially on the, she's not on the recording, but now she's part of the ensemble.
Oh, wow.
By virtue of seeing the piece and being like, what is going on? How did you make this? And, you know, it's got a lot of mystery to it for something that's pretty simple.
Yeah, that's just listening to it. It's, I don't know. It has this, I mean, I really hope I get to see a live performance of it someday, but just listening to the record, it has this effect of just, like you're talking about, people really listen. And I, yeah. It just kind of stops you and you're, you know, even I had it on, I put it on, I'd listened to it a couple times and I put it on just, I was working on something else. I was like, oh, I'm going to put this on again. And then I got so distracted, I couldn't work on the other thing. I just had to like stop and just, wow.
That is great to hear. I love this.
But there's some interesting, there's some combination of things happening that feels really special or like on an like happening on like an, I don't know, on a plane of existence I don't quite understand, which
is, yeah, oh yeah, that's what I'm talking about. That's great. I mean, yeah, that's where it's supposed to meet you for sure.
I'm curious too, like, you know, talking about sort of the collective experience of it, which is and having, you know, these different musicians and then some, you know, playing live and the audience can get involved if they want and stuff like that. I'm curious how, like, you think about that or approach, like, creating that sort of almost like a musical, like, sort of democracy. Like, I mean, it's your concept, right? It's your score. It's your, but it, yes. You're like, I always wonder how people make that shift from, it's like, okay, I've written this thing, but now it's sort of in the hands of everybody else that is part of it.
Yeah. Well, you know, so on the one hand, the piece is sort of modular in the sense that I have this idea of that I could, you know, do it anywhere with anybody, you know. But then at the same time, when I really look at it, it's very much based on not even the instrumentation, though that is an important and an integral part of it. It's more just about the people and my relationships mm-hmm. with those people and their relationships with sound and with improvisation and so forth. But you know, I like to think of it as kind of like the, you know, the piece is a time code based piece. It's literally just on a, you know, the score itself is just 44 minutes left to write. And then just lines for each instrument. And that line is where you play. And, you know, we kind of mark, you know, subdivide up the timing, you know, there's a 22 right. minute mark, and there's an 11 minute mark, a 33 minute mark. And just sort of, you know, everything's supposed to, you use that as a guide as when to play and when to not play. And when you're not playing, you're supposed to sing. And, and there's very little precision with that. There's like, you know, in that piece, there's a couple of places where everybody's supposed to stop at one point. And, but other than that, it's pretty open. And then the notes are very like generous in the sense of there's a lot of notes about how to approach this thing and how to look at it. And, it's supposed to be very dynamically soft. It's supposed to be, you know, triple pianissimo to pianissimo is kind of like the main place you're supposed to hang out in. But then when you listen to the record, it's not that. And right. there's a huge caveat at the end of all the notes that is like, you know, disregard all of this at any point if the music makes more sense.
Yeah.
And you know, when you're supposed to stop and when you're supposed to start are also malleable based off of, you know, so it's a trust-based piece. And it's very much about the personalities of the group and these relationships that I have with these people. And the excitement, I mean, there's something palatably exciting about this combination of people and the approach to this music for whatever reason. You know, I very much, you know, it's been a long time since I put my name on anything. And led anything and you know, and I had a sort of punk rock, you know, guilt about the idea of even telling people what to do. And then I kind of realized with it that I, you know, that it, you sometimes you have to tell people what to do if you have a vision of what you want to hear. And
yeah.
And you know, and also I love being told what to do. I love when somebody says like, no, don't do that, do this. And I'm like, hell yeah. Like, you know, it's a craft and you're serving this greater thing. And so wrapping my mind around the fact that like, you know, that nobody's going to be insulted. In fact, they're going to take to it. And if they are insulted, then they're not going to be part, then they don't want to be a part of it.
Right.
Like did I have trusting friend? I mean, it's hard enough to believe that I have these friends that play their instruments as well as they do, and that they want to, and that the fact that they want to play that their instruments with me is, you know, is often very humbling. And so, you know, the idea of me trying to tell somebody that I hold in such high regard, you know, when to play and when to not play is, you know, it's very, it took me a minute to really get my mind around the fact that this is a worthy cause and this is worthy, of, you know?
Yeah, no, I relate to that so much of where that dichotomy of like, please tell me what to do, but oh God, I can't tell you what to do. Yeah,
exactly. It's so weird.
And yeah, before we get into the songs, I do want like the ensemble on this record is unreal. Like you've got, it's like all my favorite musicians.
It's pretty exciting. And they're all, you know, like when the record was, when, you know, Lobby Art got in touch about wanting to put it out, you know, I was like, oh God, I don't have any money. You know, there's the money thing and, you know, and everybody was like, put the record out. What are you talking about? Like, why would, you know, like that's not, we're not going to hold, you know, of course people were appreciative that I asked and, you know, and when there is money and, you know, I'm definitely will share it, but you know, it's the world we live in you know, and I'm thinking of it now, just slightly going back to, I remember I was hanging out with Chris Corsano maybe about a year ago, and he had just recently had played with Wendy Eisenberg, and it was, you know, him and I share a very similar kind of punk rock take to free jazz and free improv and all this stuff, and it's part of our background and we're peers in that way. And I just remember him remarking on something that Wendy had said about notation and that like the validity of notation and, you know, and the music that we're playing. And he's like, you know, and basically he was commenting on how like, fresh of breath of air or a breath of fresh air kind of thing that it was to hear somebody, just their take on notation as being like, you know, it's still in the same world. It's just a quicker way to explain what it is that you want to hear. And, you know, in certain cases. And so, you know, and I remember like being like, yeah, it's kind of cheating a little bit, but I was like, no, and then the more I thought of it and, you know, ruminated on it, I was like, yeah, actually it is a completely valid way of self-expression. And it can't be as valid as, you know, the free improv and the making things up in the moment and, you know, and all that stuff. And that there is nothing problematic inherently with telling somebody, writing down what you want somebody to play. So anyway, yeah, the band itself is unbelievable musicianship and incredible friends. And, you know, and it's continuing to grow. I'm doing the record release in next month. And there's a lot of people who are on the record who aren't able to make it. So I'm, you know, coming up with all these new people that are going to play with it. And I realized that it's not the instruments. It's very much just the the personalities and the musicianship that's within those personalities, you know.
That's awesome. Well, I really love this record. It's been
thank you so much. That's so exciting.
I hear a ton of music every year, people, and like but this has been one that has so stood out to me. So I everybody who's listening to this, buy the record.
Yeah, that's very exciting. Thank you so much.
Okay, well, I don't have any good segue here, so we're just gonna transition here into the questionnaire. And as always, I'm gonna start with the first question of what is the first song that you remember?
Okay, so yeah, this is one of the least maddening questions on the list, and yet still impossible. So anyway, I'm first glance is Clementine.
Yeah,
you know, Oh My Darling Clementine. And I remember, I mean, it's either that or Disco Duck, and Disco Duck is something that it doesn't have the resonance. I just remember having that record, and I remember playing it a lot. Mm-hmm. But even when looking at these questions beforehand, I you know, found a YouTube version of Disco Duck and listened to it, and I was like, nah, this doesn't really stick. So I think it's Clementine, nevertheless.
Yeah.
It was in a movie, and I looked up, you know, there's a John Ford movie that has that in a title, and it's not that one because I remember it being in like color, but it was on TV. And I just remember there was like a woman stuck in a well and or something, something like that, you know, like kind of like situation, and she was singing herself, like self-soothing, using this Clementine, and that ended up being the way she was found or something like that. It cannot be that hard to find out what movie this is, but I haven't been able to yet. But nevertheless, I just remember it being very evocative to me as a kid. It, like, you know, the song I feel like I already knew, but it is one of those songs that you know that it does feel ready-made, like you already know it even before you've heard it. And it's the lullaby aspect of it and the self-soothing aspect of it in the movie, and the way that it played and as a almost even a plot point or something became very signature for me in terms of the power of music. And you know, I just remember it being very evocative and very engaging.
Yeah, that the self-soothing aspect of it, that is, like, especially to sort of see and a representation of that, like, is it such a young age? I don't know that. Yeah, I can. That would be very impactful, I think. And the song,
like, yeah. I was a kid. I was very little. I mean, I remember being like under 5 years old or something. But, you know, my parents listened to a lot of music. They were very young when I was born, and I grew up in a house with a lot of music being played on the record player, and there was like an active. You know, that was a character in my life, was the stereo and whatever was being played. So there was a lot. I was exposed to a lot of music from a very, very early age. But that one stuck out, and that was one that my parents weren't playing. That was something me engaged with TV or something.
Yeah. What is a song that either actually makes you cry or it makes you feel some kind of way, that kind of way?
Yeah. This one is impossible. There's I can cry at fucking I could cry at Disco Duck. I can cry at anything. Yeah. But so I came up, the last one that I really, really cried to is the one I went with. And, you know, which is to say that there's been a bunch since then that I cried to, and a lot of songs can make me cry. Beautiful songs, powerful songs, sad songs, idiot. But it was Nick of Time by Bonnie Raitt, I think was and it just gets me in this way. It's a pretty cheesy song in my memory, you know, like I don't necessarily hold it up to something like that. And then listening to it, I see how just incredibly vulnerable it is and incredibly honest. And, you know, it's a pop song, you know, it was did it on David Letterman. She was the name of the record. You know, it was a big kind of a comeback record for her. I saw that tour when I was like in fifth grade when it came out. That, you know, that's the one that it's got Let's Give Him Something to Talk About with Dennis Quaid in it in the video. And it's, I mean, pretty unhinged, cheesy, but man, that song, her Letterman version is so great. She's playing keyboard. She's not even playing like her signature, you know, slide guitar stuff. And it's clear she had a vision of what she wanted to talk about, which was aging and the vulnerability mm-hmm. that comes with that. I cried about it when I got my mother, when my mother passed away like 5 years ago. I went home to see my father, and I just played that song that's at random for some reason, and it had already been on my mind, I think, from Tara Jane O'Neill and I were talking about Bonnie Raitt and recently, and she reminded me of kind of like a stranger period of her career in the 80s when everybody was kind of being weird. You know, how pop stars and, you know, Pantheon people, you know, everybody went through world changes and things and, you know, sartorially and haircut wise. You know? So anyway, the way she navigated it is kind of amazing. That song has just got so much truth to it. And it's not talking about issues that are not talked about in pop radio or music and video and MTV music and stuff like that, you know?
Yeah, I remember that, the whole like Nick of Time comeback, and because I mean it was everywhere, and I was probably in like fifth grade or so. I was like 10 around that time, and I was like, that was in my, I was super into like Guns N' Roses and Motley Crue, and so I didn't get it at the time, but then years and years later, I was having a conversation with somebody, and they were talking about, I think it was You Can't Make Me, I Can't Make You Love Me. As being one of those, just, you know, and I was like, it's like my memory of this is just being, you know, a dumb kid who was annoyed that she won the Grammy and not Guns N' Roses. And then just like kind of went back and revisit. And it was, I mean, it's so, it kind of just, like really blew me away about, like you said, like, especially like this song, so the way, like how vulnerable it is, the things she's singing about, the way like the songs are just written and constructed and play, it just it's pretty remarkable stuff. But this song is, man,
what a song. She has so much intention going on there, you know, and it's strange. There's on YouTube, there's this like 45 minute interview that she does with Bob Costas of all people, and it's so stayed and affected, like the way he even holds himself in the chair when he's, you know, doing this, you know, candid interview with this pop star and all that stuff, and yet her answering these questions, like she is very much aware of who she is and what she's doing, and she's talking a lot about how she's you know, it's for this record for Nick of Time, and and she is talking about, like, you know, how hard it is to be old in this industry, and, you know, and then, you know, I did the math, and I think she says it at some point, she's 39 when she's doing the interview, and I'm like, god damn, that's not old at all. And like, but I, for nobody had been old,
right,
you know, who had a career in the 70s and late 60s, and, you know, like nobody, everybody was trying to, and the 80s was a big about face politically and culturally about what these people had established themselves with. So anyway, it's clear that she is aware, you know, very self-aware, and it's also, it feels like, I mean, this is very much me projecting onto the thing, and she doesn't say this explicitly by any means, but it feels like she's like, you know, this might be my last one, and so I'm just going to do exactly what I am going through, what I'm thinking about, because I think she had made a record before that didn't sell very well, and it, you know, she was really worried about her career. And meanwhile, you know, she just played, you know, she just did a big tour this last year, and I unfortunately missed it. But and you know, we're talking about a woman who an incredible genius artist that, you know, she plays Angel from Montgomery every show she plays, you know, like the John Prine song.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she knows what a good song is, and she holds that as important as her musicianship, and I don't know, I'm very inspired by her.
Yeah, same.
Yeah, cool.
On the other side, what's a song that'll put you in a better mood?
Oh, absolutely. You know, which is I would say crying is a very important thing when listening to music. And I would say that that almost is putting you in a better mood in a way that, you know, of it. So I wouldn't look at it as the opposite, but a song that always puts me in a better mood is Standing on the Verge of Getting It On by Funkadelic.
Oh man. Yeah.
I think that is one of the more incredible anthematic songs that is, it's just unbelievable what it's dealing with lyrically, but also even if you took away the lyrics or if it was in a language that I didn't speak, you would know exactly the hypeness of it and the enriching betterment for the, you know, your fellow person that it's involved itself with, you know.
Yeah, it's I don't know. Yeah, it's like funk is transcendence or something. It's so
good. It's so crazy.
Every time I go through many phases. It's like Funkadelic is the greatest band of all time, I think.
I mean, definitely when they're on, there's not a better band.
Yeah.
You know, when I got this question, this Google Doc of all these questions, I was like, you know what, I can just answer all these with Funkadelic and Parliament songs. Right. And I was thinking like I should do that, or, you know, it was like either that or Bob Dylan, or, you know, taking just a survey of just one artist and answering all these questions with them. But yeah, Funkadelic, you know, and it's weird how I grew up with them because of, you know, before I ever really even heard them, I'd been listening to them through mainly probably De La Soul, but through hip hop in general, sampling them. And so when I finally did turn my focus to Maggot Brain, I think it was the first one I got, and Tear Your Ass and Your Mind Will Follow, and those first couple records, they were so familiar already, because, you know, De La had just sampled them so much, and I was such an insane De La Soul fan from, you know, fifth or sixth grade. And so, I think it's important. I remember reading this interview with Hank Shockley from the Bomb Squad, Public Enemy's, you know, producers and stuff. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about Stevie Wonder, and he was comparing what they were hoping that they could do as producers and with Public Enemy was that they could do something along the lines of what Stevie Wonder was to them, which was, you know, when they were eight, they heard Signed, Sealed, and Delivered on the radio. That was just a fun song. And then, you know, it was a song that they liked, and they just resonated with them. And, you know, and they would go out and play in the playground. Their parents would be playing in the car radio, whatever. And then when they're like 12 or 13, they're starting to get interested in girls. And Stevie Wonder would be there again with a song with the same, maybe say the same song, and it would have a different meaning because it was romantic and they could hear the romantic part. Mm-hmm. And as, you know, young men, as teenagers, they would hear the song and it was political and they were engaging in a different modality. And then when they were, you know, in their 20s and they first really fell in love, and, you know, like, so how a song could be like that. And that's how I think of Funkadelic, is they have all these modalities that you can grow up with, and the song never wavers in its, you know, and what it's always going to be that initial, like something like Standing on the Verge of Getting It On is still going to have that resonance that it had for, say, the 8-year-old me, you know, like it still hypes me that way. And yet I can hear they're talking about so many incredibly complicated and beautiful things within that song, while also being like, dude, dance, you know, like,
yeah, like, yeah,
it's very clear.
Yeah, no, I think that's such a good point. Well, if it's not a Funkadelic song, what is objectively the best song of all time?
Christ, right. the best song is What Reason Could I Give, Ornette Coleman off of Science Fiction. I really, really thought about this, and I have to say that that this is it. I mean, you know, I'm going to say this is it beyond my objective purview. This is actually the best song, and you know, I really thought about this. It's so insane.
Oh my god,
you would do this to anybody and make them try to choose these things, but I'm glad I figured it out, and it is what Reason Could I Give. The lyrics, the performance, the everything that is happening rhythmically, harmonically, it is, and you know. And I think this might have been it, because you have a description underneath. It's sort of like,
Right. Like the height of, if you showed an alien, like the height of Sonic achievement.
Right. If an alien came and you wanted to show them what humanity is through song, this would be the one that you could be like, this kind of transfers all the information that I would hope to communicate to a foreign, alien thing, because, and it's funny, before answering this, I never really paid attention to the lyrics. I mean, I, of course knew that she was saying, what reason could I give and how many times, and
right.
Her name, Asha Pootley.
Yeah.
Singer. But it's really just the same verse twice, and then just a half or a quarter verse at the very end. And what she's saying, is so powerful. And, what reason could I give to live, only that I love you? How many times must I die for love? Only when I'm without you, where will the clouds be, if not in the sky when I die? It's like, God damn, dude. Settle down, it's so deep. And then meanwhile, Charlie Hayden and Ed Blackwell just like playing that double time, funkiest swinging shit. And then the melody just sweeping in and out of it. And I mean, I'm not sure still to this day. At any given moment, I could tell you exactly what Harmelotics is, but also I'm not really sure that I know what it is. But that's it. Whatever is happening in that song, the way it's transient, going in and out of itself and eating its own tail, mm-hmm. and the whole thing. And then he just throws these lyrics on top of it. I did my due diligence in Wikipedia articles and all this shit. And turns out that she had come to town and was, kind of bumming around all the recording studios and, was trying to be a starlet of some sort. Coming from like an Indian acting background in India. And John Hammond was, executive producing this record, and you recommended her to go in and audition for Ornette. And which is crazy. Like the same guy who, discovered all the jazz in the world that's so great, all the blues in the world, and, puts not only Bob Dylan on, but Bruce Springsteen on, and all these other people. But is also the one who put Asha in touch with Ornette to make this song. It's cosmic.
Man, that's incredible. Yeah, I feel like you could, in hearing that, confirm, you could write a book about this song. Just like this, the album, sure, but like this song. Like, I feel like there's so much here. And I just want to say, Ed Blackwell's been probably my favorite drummer for a long time. Yeah. And he's like the secret architecture of this piece, I think, or something. Like him and Hayden together, of course, but I don't know. I take any opportunity I can to say how much I love Ed Blackwell.
Jesus Christ. So on this specifically, because it's super, it seems so unhinged. And then when you really listen to it, you're like, oh no, he's just playing that shit. I mean, it's like it gets to, ridiculous sort of like platitude level of description where I'm at a loss for what to say about. I mean, as a drummer, of course, I'm very inspired. Sure. But then as just a musician or a lover of music, you're just like, man, that guy, it becomes like those cats are cooking kind of, And I mean, it's like what Bohannon says when he's introducing his band. It's like when Ed Blackwell's playing, everybody else get off the stage, dude. This dude is like, just he's handling it, like whatever it is, he is dealing with it straight on and giving it to you. Like it's so beautiful. It's so and it's funky as fuck too. It's like really funky.
Yeah. Well, no, I think I I've done over 100 of these now. I think you may have You found the answer to this. So. Everybody else need not apply.
We retire this question.
Right, yeah. Okay. Well, what's a song you used to love, but you've heard it recently? If you think about it now, it doesn't really quite do it for you the same way.
Right. Well, I mean, I couldn't answer this one without. This one is kind of my cop out answer, which is just any song at any given moment. Sometimes they don't, sometimes they just don't, you know, I mean, obviously the, what comes to mind is, you know, questionable taste as a teenager, sure, there are things, and, you know, I don't like Pearl Jam anymore. And I question that I ever really did, but, you know, stuff like that, but it seems very, I don't know, almost, yeah, too low hanging fruit or pedestrian to really answer it that way. I think it opens up a very interesting thing, which is that question is that, you know, you got to read the room with songs, and, you know, sometimes it's just not the right time to play that song. I mean, you know, unfortunately, one of the things that I thought of was R. Kelly. I mean, I'm a huge R. Kelly fan, and yet, you know,
the Ignition remix comes up often on this question. Cause
really?
Yeah, because it's, you know, it's arguably like the greatest pop song ever, if you ask me. But also, I understand why you kind of just can't.
You really can't. And, like, you know, and you, and it's funny, like, even, you know, I DJ, and I've DJed for a living for quite a long time, you know, way more than half my life. And you know, it's nobody plays him anymore.
Yeah.
Like, just, and, you know, people still play Kanye, you know, people still play, you know, like, I mean, during the week that he had the dinner with the Proud Boys and whatever bullshit he was up to, like, nobody blinks an eye at that. But,
yeah,
but for some reason, R. Kelly summarily just got, you know, really actually truly canceled. Anyway, so at any given moment, you know, it could be any song that's just not the right fit or the right time, or it's, you know, something that you thought you liked. There's other, you know, there's this really cool thing too that happens, and I know everybody's experienced this in some way, where you are so excited. Like, I'll say for myself, like, when I was a kid, I was very much wanted to impress my father with my, you know, with music. And I remember, like, being very excited about a song. I can't remember which one specifically, but, like, say a song. And then this, you know, like, listening to it at night before I went to bed, and in the morning knowing that he was going to give me a ride to school, and I'm, you know, 11 years old or something. And I, you know, I have the tape, I have it queued up. I put it in the, we get in the car, he's giving me a ride to school, and I play it for him. And, you know, it doesn't land, and you can feel it. You can feel when it's playing, like, the audience not receiving it the way that you had hoped, the way that you receive it. And you know that it's not right. And I kind of equate the answer to that question to that, like, where it's just like, it could be any song that is something that you thought you liked and you don't actually like it anymore, or it's not the time to play it, or, you know, and it's very humbling to have that thing that you held in such high regard somehow magically lose its charm through the framing of it, you know, just shaping it differently.
Yeah, I think that's a great answer to that. And the gosh, the situation you described with your dad. So my daughter is 12.
Yeah,
and I experience this on the other side now.
Sure,
like all the time. And I'm very, and I try to be very cognizant, because I remember,
right,
like that. And I'm like, I try to, because, like, she's really getting into K-pop right now, and
I'm,
you know, I don't have real opinion. I'm open to anything, honestly.
Sure, but sure. There you are.
But yeah, it's a really, it is a very humbling thing. I think that's a really good way to describe it, when something just doesn't land the way it did or the way you think it's going to. And
right.
Yeah.
I mean, I just started doing this radio show for East Village Radio, twice a month, every other week, and it's been a revelatory thing. You know, I DJ so much, and when they asked if I wanted to do a show, I was just like, why would I ever want to, like, DJ more for free? You know, like, it just doesn't. And then, of course, I thought about it, I was like, of course, because you can play all this music that you don't play when you're DJ for, you know, the club or whatever, the bar, and it's really got me excited about music again, and you know, in a way that I had, that had been kind of dormant for a long time. And, you know, but the day before, I think my second show, like the night before, I had this anxiety dream that I had brought the wrong bag of records to the thing. And it was all like Bill Cosby and, Molly and, you know, whoever else had been canceled at, you know, in the last few years. It was just a bag of nothing but that. And I woke up in like a panic, you know, like, But of course, now I'm like, I gotta, maybe I need to do that show and actually play all that shit. I don't know. All right.
I hope you do. Because that actually sounds incredible.
I mean, sometimes if I get real, like a very specific kind of like alcohol based mood, and I'm by myself, I will, don't tell anybody this, but yeah, I will put on R. Kelly by myself and listen and cry to him. Because of that he's truly a fucking diabolical, horrible monster person. Yeah. And yet you hear this music and you're like, what the hell happened? You know, like how does this happen?
Yeah.
And, it's weird. Anyway. Okay.
Enough about R. Kelly. What's a song? What's a song that most people, whoever these people are, people hate it. You don't care.
That's by Girly Girl Productions.
Dude, I never heard this, but this is amazing. The chorus on this is so fucking. Oh God, I was like, I was dying listening to this. I fucking love this.
Yeah, the chorus is nuts. I mean, yeah, the it's very clever, and you know, everybody thinks that it's AI generated, but I don't.
I was surprised. I whenever was kind of digging into this and saw everybody talking about like, oh, AI, I was like, oh, it didn't really occur to me that it just sounds like, yeah, I didn't think it was AI generated either.
I mean, it might as well be. It's definitely coming from that
perspective.
And you know, to say that I like it and nobody else does is, I mean, I don't even know if I like it, you know, like, I mean, I'm obsessed with it and I listen to it a lot, but it's, you know, especially when I first heard it. I found it through this writer, this music writer, Ariel Gordon, who is really good at sort of understanding the substrata of like context of, you know, how why these things, you know, they're really good thought piece on Charlie X, X and stuff. And so I just, you know, they posted something on their stories on social media or something, and I was like, oh, I wonder what this song is. And I could not stop listening to it for weeks. And to the extent to where that came up, that where friends of mine would be like, dude, come on, man. Like, you know, like we get it and we heard it. And then I found it has a viral aspect to it. Like, you know, I'll walk in. I remember walking into, you know, the bar that I work at, and the sound person was playing it for the bartender as a joke, you know, like, look how ridiculous this is. I was like, this song. And then, you know, you're looking at me like, how can you love it's like saying, it's like, you're like love, like melted plastic or something. It's really, truly, a very synthetic song. Like it makes you feel bad. You know, it's not a good thing that it's dealing with. And their whole oeuvre, like their whole, you know, the Girly Girl Productions itself is very much, you know, they either have songs about doing cocaine or songs about killing men or both. But then there will be like these really cutesy takes about, you know, after they killed that man, they started wearing a shirt and they love his shirt. It's a Y2K shirt and they're obsessed with Y2K. And I think that is a Gen Z thing. Well, as I can tell, but like why is that a road sign on you know, this thing? Y2K comes up a lot, you know, like I'm a Y2K girl, I do a Y2K swirl, I love killing men. Great. And it's all Barbie based and
right.
all of it is really hollow and vapid, and yet resonates with me for some reason on a level that is maybe self-harm based, I don't know. But yeah, I would say even I hate it, and I you know, listen to it, you know.
I think that's perfect. The song you hate but also can't stop listening to, that's a good other question. Okay, what's the most romantic song?
Now this, I don't remember what I said. Let me look at the notes. I think maybe the most romantic song is In a Silent Way, Peaceful, like that record of Miles Davis's, but that's what I answered on the thing. Let me, where did I put the question? Oh, here it is. What's the most romantic song is, Infinite Love by Bernice.
Yeah.
Do you know them?
Yeah. I didn't know this.
Oh, yeah.
And was totally floored by it. When like
they're incredible.
Holy shit.
Yeah, that whole record, this new record of theirs. I met them on tour with, I was on tour with Wendy Eisenberg, and they already knew these homies, and they're Toronto based trio. Robin, the singer, just the most evocative voice and singing about, and I don't even know. I mean, that's one of the most impossible songs to answer. I mean, question to answer, and yet, I don't know. This one seems to be it. I mean, of course, then Sade, then, you know, cavalcades of, you know, centuries of music that is as romantic as anything's ever been. But at the same time, this one is the one for me right now. Infinite Love just is like, she's not even talking about romance. She's just talking about like self-love and it's kind of like picking yourself up and dusting yourself off, you know, but it's really, if you don't listen to the lyrics, it is really kind of, you know, sexy and also just invigorating.
Yeah, the way, like the whole way that, like that, how they it's produced and just like there's all these like details in it that it, in the way it's like mixed, and it just feels so intimate and like it's just wrapping itself around you or something. And
it was recorded by Lily. Oh shit, what is her last name? At Figure Eight, Lily Wren, maybe? No, and Shahzad Ismaili. They did it at Figure Eight Studios here, and it's clear that it wasn't just like, oh, let's turn it up and then it'll sound good. The song definitely crafted the mix is the ingredients of why this thing works so well, for sure.
I was so glad to be introduced to this because I'm borderline obsessed right now.
Yeah, the first song on that record is also really, really good. It's like one of the ones that, you know, that I listened to like 47 times in a row, you know, one day, you know, kind of thing. But this one was a harder one to find because it's deeper in the record and a deep cut, as they say. And once I got it, it became, replaced the opening track for me. Mm-hmm. And I listened to it constantly. I put it on every mix that I give to somebody. I'm so impressed with them. And you know, like the drummer is just playing one of those like drum pad things where it's like, you know, like, and there's cheesy sounds and they make it sound so engaging. Right. And so cool. And they're just like this really cool, like kind of dorky band from Canada that's making the most evocative music. And like, I'm very inspired by them and this record for sure. And I was so happy to find out. We were in Toronto playing. I was in a really bad mood. I was in a bunch of pain and there was no bathroom door on the door at the club. You know, it's like one of those places. And I was just like, oh God. And then I was like, who's this band that I have to listen to? And then when they played, I was like, jaw on the floor, like, oh, my whole life is brought up to this.
You know? Oh man, that's awesome. I mean, other than the pain and misery, but yeah. Of course. All right. What's a song that changed your perspective on an artist, either for better or for worse?
Right. Okay. Well, I'm gonna take the high road here, and not so for better. I'm gonna go for the better. There was one. I can't do it anyway. Yeah. Well, Wendy Eisenberg and the Pines. I was gonna answer with the Lana Del Rey song, and that resonates too. And then there's some other stuff, but I'm gonna go with In the Pines, Wendy Eisenberg. The song itself, the recording is incredible off the newest record, Viewfinder. I've been lucky enough to where I get to play this song with Wendy pretty often, and they you know, it means a lot to me that I get to perform this song anytime I get to, but also it means a lot to me to be able to hear them play it by themselves and, you know, without anybody, or to hear another drummer on it. It's just incredible. But what happened was I was a big fan of Wendy's already, and this song, when they played it for me the first time, and then after playing it with them a number of times, I realized that my opinion of Wendy, I thought, couldn't be any higher. And then I realized that no, they're actually as serious of a songwriter as anybody has ever been. And this song, and you could put this up against any other song. There's an incredible cleverness with using the idea of the murder ballad in the Pines, and what she's doing, or what they're doing with that, is you know, could almost be obscured by its cleverness, except for the song is that strong. And that's very almost subversively seemingly simple. And then you realize it's not, and what it's actually dealing with lyrically, but also musically, is very advanced, and it overcomes its own weight. It becomes its own thing. And it's anyway, it made me realize that I was in, I mean, you know, they're a good friend of mine, so I feel kind of dumb saying this, but I was in the presence of real greatness, and in terms of what a songwriter was self-actualizing. I've been playing with Wendy for a few years up to that point, and was, you know, just very impressed with their songwriting. But this one just came out of nowhere and just kind of, you know, knocked me on the head in terms of like what they were capable of and how they, their right. self achievement, and, you know, was stunning. And, you mm-hmm. know, yeah.
Now I get, like, Wendy's been one of my favorite contemporary artists, whatever, for a while, but I had like this, I mean, the Viewfinder record itself is like a masterpiece, but this song is like, you get to this song and then it's just, it's like time stops. And like, I think Deceptively Simple is such a good description. Even like the, like just the, Can You Just Be?
Oh my God.
Lyric. I mean, it seems it gives me goosebumps even just thinking about it.
Right. And it could be about anything, you know. It's almost like you're mm-hmm. sticking, you know, it almost seems, you know, it's achieving one of those things that all the great songs do, which is that they let you run with it and let you answer the questions that it's posing. And yet, you know, it's about something. When you look at those lyrics or listen to the delivery of those lyrics, you know, it's about something specific. And I think I know what it is. And I've never asked, and I don't think I ever will want to have it confirmed, because it's not the point of the song. And all the great songs do that, you know, mm-hmm. where they lead you to a certain point, but then it becomes up to you, and they trust you as a, you know, the truly great songs, a lot of country songs do that, but, you know, the truly great songs trust their audience to answer the question that is the song, you know, and, mm-hmm. and they, celebrate your, you know, your wisdom, of that you don't necessarily even know that you have. Anyway, you know, so at one point in the first verse, they're talking about, you know, the things that they've seen, and, you know, it's amazing the depth of their anger. And you're like, okay, well, shit, something's going on here. And then they're like, you know, and I'm chilled to the bone when I look at a picture of me smiling. And I'm just like, whoa, okay, some heaviness. And I can equate that to childhood trauma that I have. And I can, you know, the evocativeness of what they're talking about, something so specific, but so universal at the same time. And, you know, how do you do that? Like, that's an achievement that we should all strive for in any kind of art making, but also, you know, just in just any interaction. And the song itself begs the question, Can You Just Be? Could be, you know, to the rise of fascism, or it could also be like to you trying to meditate, or, you know, like it could be very, very, very personal. It could be very universal. It could be, you know, it's speaking to a universality that is stunning and beautiful, that she that they're able to achieve that Wendy found that is, you know, really did change my opinion of them for the better, that I was, you know, like, wow, I'm amongst greatness here, you know. It's really cool. Yeah,
that's awesome. I forgot, when I was listening to this again prepping for this, I forgot that you actually didn't play on this. I was like, oh yeah, it's Booker Stardrum Night.
Yeah, and Booker, oh my God, Booker sounds so great on it. And his, I know. You know, like the brushes are just mixed so perfectly loud, and you know, and he doesn't, he really gets out of the way of the song and just, you know, drives it just in that perfect way.
Yeah. All right, lyrics. What are what are your favorite lyrics?
I mean, you know, once again, impossible to answer, but I think that I will go with what it's been lately, and it's Bob Dylan, Bobby D, with Key West, The Philosopher's Pirate, off the newest record, Rough and Rowdy Ways. They got me, this song. I do this thing where I listen to, you know, a song over and over, mm-hmm. you know, I remember hearing that, what's his name, Bruce Springsteen, in, you know, the early 80s, he would tour with just one song. He would make a tape with the same song over and over and just listen to it the whole tour. And like, you know, he'd do these, like, I don't know,
massive,
yeah, 3/4 of the year tour, and he would just listen to, you know, Chain of Fools, Aretha Franklin, something like that. Anyway, I was talking with this friend of mine, once again, Margaret, the person who did the liner notes for the record, and you know, they do the same thing, and they're like, you know, I was like, you know, like, yeah, where it gets like crazy how much you listen to a song, and they're like, yeah, like where it's, you know, where you start to scare yourself. I was like, wait, what do you mean by, but and like, and I thought about it and I was like, yeah, it is. It's like you get taken by a song and you just listen to it so much that it is kind of frightening how engaged you are with it and how much time and you're devoting to it. Anyway, that was this song last April two Aprils ago in May. I was going through a breakup and I would walk for, you know, miles and miles and miles and just listen to the song over and over. And lyrically, it is dealing with a few different things. I don't know. I mean, you could write a book about this song for sure. And he clearly read a bunch of books. I mean, there's like all this like pseudo history and then real history about, you know, about Key West. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's obviously a very magical and evocative place for many people. Hemingway, obviously, and, you know, Cortez, you know, everybody seems to have Jimmy Buffett, you know.
Yeah.
I'm a real I've never been, but I feel either. Like the song takes me there. But ultimately, yeah. What I think the song is dealing with is a semi-autobiographical sort of kiss my ass thing that he's saying. And he keeps saying, you know, even at the very last line is, you know, he uses this refrain about when talking about the Key West, he always says down on the bottom, you know, way down at the bottom by the Gulf of Mexico, down at the bottom. So the very last line of the song, it's like a 9.5 minute song. He says something about, you know, I don't love nobody, give me a kiss. And then he goes back into that refrain down at the bottom. Mm-hmm. On the way down in Key West, and you're like, he's literally saying kiss my ass, like, you know, give me a kiss down at the bottom or whatever. And you know, that's me reaching a little bit, but anyway, he talks a lot about the foliage that is native to that area, and mm-hmm. At one point in the second verse, I believe, he talks about his influences, you know, Corso, Kerouac, Ginsberg, they grew up on the wrong side of the tracks, just like him. And then he talks about Buddy. Well, I'm guessing Buddy Holly. He saw Buddy Holly when he was young. And Jimmy and Louie and all the rest. And then he's like, then he talks about he's standing with his feet planted straight on the ground. He's got his hand up and his thumb down. Such is life, such is happiness. And that moment, I believe, is when he transfers himself into part of the... He becomes a tree himself, and is not only inspired by the foliage and, you know, he talks about hibiscus flowers. He talks about, he hides this gumbo limbo place. It's actually like a nature preserve in Boca Raton. He uses it in a poetic way that he's learned all the gumbo limbo rituals and all the stuff. But anyway, I think he's identifying himself as part of the scenery of this place and the magicalness of it and the intoxication of the heat and that, you know, summer is endless there, that there's no such thing as winter there, and that he is, so it's a very bespoke place and that he is part of that. And he, I think also he's dealing with, you know, there's this idea. I remember reading Richard Alpert, you know, Ram Dass was talking about seeing this mm-hmm. guru of his, and that his guru would had all these followers around him, mainly that the followers there were to make sure that he didn't disappear into the landscape, that he was so enlightened that he could just be, if he just walked off by himself, he could just become part of the forest. And in India or something. And it's kind of what I think is like that same idea as what Dylan's talking about right now, is like that he is part of, he's melding into the landscape. He's becoming so it to where he can't differentiate himself from the trees. And then at the same time, then there's this whole other thing going on about this sort of very liminal thing, you know, this liminal space that Key West has mythically, but also physically. And I do know that he would spend some times there, you know, to reading different biographies and stuff, that he definitely did songwriting, you know, retreats there, or he would find himself there. I was at the place where I was like, what do you think about the song? I could talk about this forever. What do you have any thoughts about? You're in it. Were you familiar with it?
Yeah, I knew the song. Like, I think I really like your take on it. Like, it always had this kind of mythic quality to it.
Sure.
To me, like, I think that part of it. But the thing with the tree, like that, I'm going to be thinking about that after this conversation, because I think that's really, I think that's a really, I really like that read on it. And I really love this song. I really love this album. I love, just outside of the lyrics perspective, I just love how, I especially love how his voice sounds on this record and on this song.
It's pretty amazing what he's able to do with the limited voice that he has at that point. I mean, I think that doing the triplicate record of all the American Songbook songs, you know, all these kind of standards and stuff was, you know, it really informed his singing voice for sure. You know, and there's a bunch of the mythic quality, you know, that it starts out talking about McKinley, and then they talk about Truman, you know, and then the wireless radio being the thread that goes in and out. You know, like, it kind of ties the first verse, the opening of the first verse and the ending of the last verse together, that he was listening. He's been listening. All of this is going through this wireless radio thing. And I'm like, what does that have to do with Key West? And he talks about that he's tuning into the wireless radio coming out of somewhere in Budapest. And like, and you're just like, what are you talking about? Like, you know, but then you realize that, yeah, he's like, there's an impressionistic thing happening, but he's also citing very specific, like McKinley hollered, McKinley squalled has come from a Charlie Poole song, about like White House Blues, I think is the name of the song. And then I don't love, but then he cites, you know, Try a Little Tenderness. He cites like four or five different songs. It might not be the thing to do, but I'm sticking with you is like maybe almost even a Velvet Underground allusion or something. But you know, just okay to answer the question in terms of like why my favorite lyrics. He's got the line about, you know, I was 12 years old. They put me in a suit, forced me to marry a prostitute. There were golden fringes all around her dress. That's my story, but not where it ends. She's still cute, and we're still friends. It's just like, what the fuck, man? I don't know. I find that to be, you know, on one hand, so funny, and at the same time, just really dark and really beyond clever. Like, it's something. He was dealing with something, and you know, and it's okay that it is seemingly sprawling, but I think that there's something very specific that is going on. You know, once again, it's, you know, it's a song that trusts you to kind of make it up, but what's really happening. But it's also like, I don't know. I mean, there's the natural phenomenon of the world of how radio works, and it's like wireless radio, and just like how trees grow and how the ocean, you know, if you lost your mind, you'll find it there. You know, it is the promised land. You know, Key West is like this, so evocative, and it makes me actually. It's so good that it makes me not want to go to Key West. I don't want to find out where it is. So good.
Yeah. No. That makes total sense. I don't have much to add. I think that's such a Like I said, I'm gonna be thinking about the trees thing, especially. I don't know why that is, just my brain is latching onto that, and I'm.
I got to a place where I couldn't listen to it anymore without doing some homework, and I broke it down. Like, hopefully, like did like a, you know, my version of like a book report about it. I made an outline about, you know, what it.
Oh, that's awesome.
What, you know, like all the symbolism and all the, you know, I did the thing to, you know, critical thinking about it, and that was kind of the place where I ended up, was that he is talking about, and you know, and it could be a character, but I mean, you know, everything's sort of semi-autobiographical with him at times.
Sure.
And, I think that, yeah, that he's talking about being as steadfast as a tree, you know, planted by the water, you know, like use that, you know, gospel illusion or something. It's like something as, you know, undeniable as, you know, a tree and what that means and what that does and, you know, what its role is and it's, you know, it's really cool.
Yeah. So what's a lyric you thought you knew, but then you learned it was something else and it kind of blew your mind.
Right. So there's a bunch of these, but I would say that I have a my own clever take on the answer to this question, which was I went to go see this cool show the other day of, do you know David Ferguson, Ferg? He's like a Nashville writer and engineer. Pat McLaughlin. Pat McLaughlin is a singer-songwriter from the late 70s, 80s, 90s, and they're kind of contemporaries of each other. Thick as Thieves, sort of background Nashville guys. And I think, if I understand correctly, Ferg was sort of adopted by the Johnny Cash world when that before, but then definitely during the renaissance of Rick Rubin, and he was like his engineer at his studio, and I think he helped write some songs, and he's written some incredible songs, like but he also did the soundtrack to Red Dawn Redemption thing. He was the producer of that, and you know, him and Matt Sweeney did that shit together, and so that's how I know this guy. It's through Matt Sweeney. And I had the chance to see him play a couple of times in these very informal situations. Once at a basement and at a bar in Lower East Side and Max Fish, and you know, but recently I just saw him. And he, so anyway, to answer the question, he was introducing, he's, you know, they're trading guitars back and forth. Pat McLaughlin wrote Summer's End, like one of the very last John Prine songs. He co-wrote that with John Prine, and he's maybe more the composite of the Prine world to David Ferguson's Cash, Johnny Cash world.
Gotcha. Anyway,
he's introduced, Ferg's introducing a song and, you know, just kind of picking in. He's like, you know, this song is a Johnny Cash song. And, you know, it's kind of a sad song. It's a, what's it? What the fuck is the name of it? It's Home of the Blues. Right. And it's a breakup song, but you know, ever since he broke up with this lady, now he rests his head in the Home of the Blues, or he lives at the Home of the Blues. And so, you know, you think, you know what the song is about. It's pretty clear. And then, so he's like, yeah, this song's about a Johnny Cash's favorite record store. You know, whenever he had some free time, or he was in a bad mood, or he was in a good mood, he'd always go down to the Home of the Blues. And that was the name of this record store in Nashville. And, you know, and then you listen to the song with that take and you're like, oh, that's what, yeah, he's just talking about the record shop. And you can, you know, he's like, you can find him at the Home of the Blues most of the time. That's where he's going to be.
Amazing.
Yeah. So I was like, you know, it's not a song that I had confused necessarily, sure, but so eye-opening that, you know, like that, and it is still a breakup song too, but you know.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, I remember my dad had to pull over the car because he was laughing so hard because we were listening to early Stones, and I thought that song Complicated was, I was singing along to it, you know, full unabashed, you know, she's so constipated. That's what I thought the lyrics were. So I wasn't a big surprise to find out those weren't the lyrics because I was just a little kid, but.
Right.
I'm like, what's she complicated about? And I didn't even know, necessarily even know what constipated meant. I just had heard the word and it.
Yeah. That's great. Now, what cover song's better than the original?
Right. Okay. Well, I'll just answer. I think it's so Daniel Johnston was, you know, before he started making his tapes and everything, and Daniel Johnston was, you know, obviously clearly a music fan. He very much obviously loves the Beatles and loves. Anyway, he was going to see this woman he had a crush on who had like a residency every week at some place in Austin. And I've heard this story secondhand from a couple different people. But anyway, so one day he brought her a tape of a bunch of his songs, like, you know, 10 songs or something. And he gave it to her, and then he came back the next week and she was like, oh, Daniel, I loved it. I wish I could remember the artist who he was infatuated with, but she was, you know, I love this, you know, would you want to open for me sometime? And he, you know, it was a dream come true. Not only does she love it, but she include him in her life, and he gets a chance to perform. And he's like, I would love to, you know, sure. And so she says, yeah, well, you know what? You should bring more tapes next week. And he was like, what do you mean? And she's like, well, you should make more of those tapes, that like that one you made me. And he's like, oh, how many? And she's like, I don't know, like 10 or 20. And he's very downtrodden. And he's like, oh, okay. Like, and seemingly intimidated by the prospect of having to make more tapes. Mm-hmm. Turns out he doesn't know about mass reproduction. And so he went home and did 10 tapes again. Like, he made them singular.
Oh, like, man.
He just redid the set 10 times.
Wow.
And I think that is the most important covers that ever existed.
Yeah.
The reason that answered that question to me. I mean, there's so many examples of covers being original. I mean, being better than the original, but I mean, just the anti-hubris of doing that, that like, of that he,
yeah,
you know, and that he doesn't, you know, there's also, it invites sort of maybe like a fascination about his ignorance of, you know, how the world works, but it's not about that. It's about that he did that, you know, that he made mm-hmm. those songs again, and that what that means, and what, and also just hear those would be just so important. I wonder where are. And, you know, it's like, if, you know, there's a box set coming out of all the tapes, like 20 tapes or something, that Joyful Noise, I think, is putting out. But anyway, and I'm like, man, if we could get those, I would listen to those, like, so, like, I can compare and contrast how they're different and what they've worked with, you know, and, you know, and because so many of those tapes, he was just using, you know, like sermons, like tapes that his parents had around the house.
Right.
And so the sermon comes in and out, you know, because of the recording quality on his cassette player, what he was doing, it was probably like a boombox or something. It wasn't like high fidelity or anything. So there's already a really cool patina that's on the tapes that he made that were mass produced. So you can only imagine how singular each one of these 10 would have been. But, you know, I think it's fascinating. And it's kind of like the same thing as, you know, like Hazel Atkins was a one man band because he thought that's what his hero, Hank Williams, it didn't say Hank Williams and the, you know, Furious Seven or whatever, you know, he didn't know there was a band. He thought Hank Williams did all of it. And so he, you know, it's kind of something along those lines of like this incredible take on something that we all assumptively know, you know, the
right
mass production and like, you know, then recreating thing. It's on that level. So I also wonder what else he thought about, you know, how they make records. Did they like, how was, you know, like, anyway, but the other thing is, I think that it's also very interesting when people cover themselves and there's a difference, and I don't know what it is exactly, but you know, like I just saw Willie Nelson a couple months or a month ago, and I don't think he ever covers himself. Whereas Bob Dylan, you know, was on the same thing. Right. And I think he does cover himself, and he has been covering himself for a really long time. Mm-hmm. But I think Willie Nelson is still it's just exactly the, you know, he always starts with Whiskey River. I've seen him 20 something times growing up in Texas and everything. Mm-hmm. And to this day, I don't think I've ever, you know, and then like that Shadow record that Dylan made during the pandemic or whatever, like that is literally a covers record of his own song. And then, you know, Cat Power had that record where she covers, you know, the covers record. And she does like New York, New York, and, you know, like big songs, but she also does her own songs. She covers mm-hmm. like her own song. And I remember being like blown away by that. And like, so mm-hmm. sometimes, you know, and I don't even know if it's better or worse, but it's just what that means and what it means as an artist, as a legacy artist, to cover mm-hmm. yourself at a certain point. And what's the difference when you're not, you know, like what's the difference between Dylan covering himself and Willie Nelson not covering himself, even though he's been doing those songs? It's very interesting.
No, that isn't. Yeah.
So that's what I came up with.
That's an awesome. I love that. That story is amazing. I never heard that Danny Jones story. Yeah, that's that's so awesome. Yeah. Wow. They need to put that on somebody track those down and put a box set out of those.
You know, it's so cool. I actually got a tape from him. You could get a tape from him at Donald's. He worked there, and there was the rumor that he would sell tapes, you know, from as a cashier. And I remember, you know, taking the Sojourn up with my mom at like 13 or something and asking her to take me to, she was, you know, trying to foster my bohemianness at age 13. Mm-hmm. So we went to like a head shop and I got like some hemp purse or some shit and right. you know, things like that. And I was, she was like, so where else do you want to go? You know, besides the record store. And I was like, I want to go to this McDonald's. And I was vegetarian at the time and all of a sudden she was like, what? And I went in and like ordered a milkshake and then was like, hey, can I get one of those tapes? And I thought it was him. I didn't know what he looked like. I imagined that it had to be him. And he was like, kind of looked around and he like slid me one. And I slid him a five, you know, and yeah, I got more Songs of Pain directly from the guy. Yeah.
Man, that's so cool. Okay. What's the song that means the most to you? Not necessarily because of the song itself, but associate it with something or someone or an experience.
Means the most to you? Is that what the, was that what it was? What is the song that changed it? Okay. Was
we're on the last two.
Yeah. Well, that means the most to you. Well, shit. Okay. I don't know if this is the correct answer, but it's what I came up with. I think it's Earth, Wind, and Fire. The way that's the way of the world. You know, it just, and not because I think it answers the second part of the question more, which is, you know, not because of the song necessarily. I do love that song, and it is one of the, it's one of the
like, songs. Yeah, it's like a perfect song.
But just the arbitrariness of it, the randomness of it is that one time I had to put a cat of mine down. I was at the, vet, you know, the emergency vet at like 3:30 in the morning. You know, it was one of the saddest, you know, situations where it was a breakup and I didn't have the cat anymore because I was couch surfing. So I had the cat at a friend's house and he was like, hey, man, you know, it's getting pretty dire. I'd had the cat. I'd moved from Texas up to New York with that cat. And, you know, and I was pretty destitute emotionally and didn't think much of myself. And then I had to go kill this cat. And, you know, So anyway, I'm at this vet and there, you know, you get to say goodbye and you're sitting there. And, he was so sick and Skeeter was the best dude. But anyway, in the background, in the lobby, that song was on the radio.
And, oh, wow.
And it just means everything to me because it, you know, that's the way of the world.
The way of the world.
Right now. But, and I got to say goodbye to him with that, you know, that, and you know, it was beautiful. And I just mean it. So that song is just anytime I hear it and I play it pretty often when I DJ and stuff, it's just, it's, you know, it's really, really great song.
Yeah. Man. Whew. All right. Last question. What is your favorite song? Either this is always the answer or this moment in time, however you want to do it. What's your favorite song?
Well, first of all, I don't know if anybody's ever told you this, but fuck you for asking me that question. I gotta go with Manzanar by our man Van Dyke Parks.
Yeah.
Do you know the song?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's man.
Yeah.
I don't even know what to say about it. It's such a like. I mean, you know, when you think about like the what it's about, and but it's this. Whew. It's like so heavy, right? It's like the, but then it's like this haunting sort of meditation and there's like all this beauty in it and it's unsettling and it's,
He shouldn't be allowed to make a song. I mean, you know, there's something like deeply strange about that. It's, you know, it's an 80s record. Has been at that point even. You know, the Tokyo Rose is a weird record and then the middle of like, and that what he's dealing with. I mean, you know, real, true, deep, deep shame, sorrowful shame about the legacy of this country, but he does it in this way that is so personal and, you know, pretty tongue in cheek and clever at the same time is not holding any of the punches, right. Like really indicting, the vapidness of LA and identifying with it and you know, putting himself to the same test that he's putting everything else to. And I sort of fear that it's a little too clever, but then I listen to it and I'm like, no, man, it's as clever as it has to be to get mm-hmm. these kind of complicated things going. I love it. And it's, you know, it's appropriating questions right on the edge of some, you know, some sort of racist appropriation kind of stuff happening with the Oriental aspect of what's happening. You know, like there's all these things, mm-hmm. but all those things play perfectly and correctly for what the indictment that he is casting on the that subject matter of Manzanar and the, you know, just the sadness of and the backwardsness of what that means, you know, what it meant to do, have these internment camps and he equates it with, you know, he talks about a desert storm at one point and that was happening mm-hmm. that, you know, desert storm was actively going on. And yeah, I don't know. I think he's, you know, we all know him to be this arranger and just this incredible arranger and, you know, unparalleled on, you know, on like the Ives aspect of his arrangement and like how he's able to understand contemporary new music composer stuff, you know, even something like Ruth Crawford Seeger, but at the same time being somebody like, you know, like a shepherd for folk tradition on this level that isn't purist, like, you know, isn't like the Bob Dylan take on that or the Lomax take on that. It's like, it's actually just the real spirit of what these things are about. And, you know, when you talk about the great songwriters, he's not one that comes up. And even though, you know, I think it's his arrangement just overshadows anything else that he does in so many cases. And even something like Song Cycle, you know, it's just the production value itself is just shines so brightly that you kind of lose track of that. These are like cool songs and that he is a songwriter, but like that, you know, but then, you know, you listen to like the Joanna Newsom record that he arranged and you're like, oh, well, that's really what he does. And, you know, so with Manzanar, you're like, no, this is a song. I mean, this is mm-hmm. the song, like he wrote this and the production is all over the place and it's all important and all this stuff, but it's about mm-hmm. that song and about those lyrics. And you know, I don't know. I find him to be, of course it's not the correct answer. There's millions of other greatest songs or whatever, but it is the one right now.
I can't argue with any of that. Thanks again for doing this. This was a lot of fun.
It's incredible.
Even though you hated it, clearly.
It was the worst. I mean, it took me so long to just even open up the Google Doc once I realized what was in there. It was just, it's monstrous. It's my own personal hell trying to commit to anything like this. But, you know, and of course, then now I'm like, wait, I didn't include any hip hop. Right. I didn't, like, you know, some of the best lyrics are definitely, you know, special ed, I got it made or whatever, you know, like the vapors, like the Biz Marquis got some of the best lyrics ever. But, you know, and then I went out something really cheesy, you know, obvious like Bob Dylan, but it's a deep cut. So, yeah. Some of, you know, like I questioned my very existence trying to answer these questions. Well, thank you for that.
Yeah. Well, thanks for doing it. And I'm sorry. record is out on October 3rd. Everybody needs to hear it.
Record release party on October 23rd.
Okay. Where at? In New York, I assume?
At Union Pool, back into the scene of the crime.
Beautiful. All right. Everybody go see it. Once again, thank you to Ryan Sawyer taking the time, coming on, just having fun, you know? Ah, great stuff. For those who wish to sing, we'll always find a song. Also, like, perfect sort of theme for this whole podcast, right? Anyways, October 3rd via Lobby Art, and just another shout out for that label. Everything they do is gold and highly recommend checking out anything they've got going on. Ryan's playlist is linked in the show notes. Hey, if you like this show, please leave a rating, review, subscribe, wherever you listen to podcasts, all that stuff. If you don't want ads, You want to really help keep it going? Patreon.com/FoxyDigitalis does the deal. I appreciate all you. Till next time, keep on listening, whatever the hell you want.